Devoncast from Radio X.
Devoncast is back, presenting the sounds of Devon and the best stories from the notebooks of the local democracy reporting service team. It's been another very varied week around the county, and we have a hand-picked batch of goodies to bring you this week. I'm Bradley Gerrard, and I'm joined in the studio today by my local democracy reporting service colleagues Alison Stevenson and Guy Henderson.
We've got a World Cup coming to Exeter this summer, as some of the best teams in women's rugby go toe-to-toe at Sandy Park. But did you know we have another World Cup coming to the English Riviera next year? We'll be recommending a film for you and finding out how £20 million of government money might be spent in Torquay. Plus, a West Devon college may have to close its sixth form due to dwindling student numbers. There are some big changes to your Devoncast to come, and we'll tell you about those later on.
But first, Northbrook Pool. To bring you up to date on a story that we've been covering on Devoncast in some detail for quite a long time, Exeter's Northbrook Swimming Pool is to close. The decision was taken by the City Council's Executive Committee last night, as we speak, despite months of campaigning by pool users to save it. Council leader Phil Bialik said it boiled down to the cold, hard facts that the pool was underused and too expensive to run. The closure will save the council more than £500,000 as it tries to make up a £3.5 million budget shortfall. Councillor Bialik told the meeting there'd been sleepless and troubled times over this, but opposition councillors said the city was washing its hands of the needs of the pool users, the people who campaigned so hard to save their pool, dressed in black last night to attend the meeting. Afterwards, they said they were disgusted and felt they'd been badly let down. What'll happen now is that the council will hand back the lease on the pool to the Northbrook Trust, and there'll be discussions on keeping it going as a community asset, which is what happens very successfully at Topsham, as well as a number of other places in Devon. The elephant in the room, though, is the amount it'll cost to bring Northbrook Pool up to scratch. We will keep you posted. That's a story that'll run and run for a little while yet.
Now to Okehampton, where the college is facing a funding crisis in its sixth form and may have to close it. It only has 12 students signed up for year 12 in September from a cohort of 200, and this comes after several years of falling student numbers. With better links to Exeter from Okehampton after the reinstatement of passenger train services, more students are taking up courses at Exeter College, where there's a wider range of courses on offer. Less students means less funding, and Okehampton College had a drop-in session last week to find out the feelings of the community. Speaking to lots of people during the well-attended event, it was pretty clear that current sixth form students, parents and local councillors are not willing to let it go without a fight. The current consultation on the future of post-16 education at the college ends next month, after which time trustees of the Dartmoor Multi Academy Trust, who run the school, will make a decision whether to close the sixth form, keep it open or offer a lower range of options. I spoke to CEO of the trust, Rachel Shaw, to find out more.
The absolute last thing we want to do is close the sixth form. So if we can find solutions in our community, if we can rally people and really raise the profile and get more students coming there, then, you know, we will fight tooth and nail to do what we can to find solutions for the situation we currently find ourselves in.
So tell me about the nuts and bolts, the funding. That is the issue, isn't it? You don't have enough students to get the funding in to keep it going.
So, yeah, one of the challenges, I think, around running a post-16 provision, A-levels in particular, is that you obviously want to offer the students a breadth of A-levels. So each student might want to pick three or four different A-levels. So if you only run six, they haven't got a wide range of choice. So maybe you need to run 25, 30, whatever that number might be. And then ideally, all the government recommendations are you need about 8 to 9 students per class to cover the cost of the funding and to deliver it. So the challenge is as numbers fall, you're left in a position of you run classes where you're having to obviously put additional funding in from elsewhere in the school to cover the fact that you're running a class for only one or two students. Or you then think, well, do we reduce the offer so that we're not having to run as many A-levels, but then it's not as attractive to students. So you get stuck in this kind of chicken and egg scenario, and we want to be able to offer a breadth so that students really are excited about coming, but we also need to get more students coming to the sixth form. And that's going to be the piece of work where, you know, we engage the community, we raise awareness of how vulnerable the sixth forms become. So that makes people start thinking, oh, this offer's here right in our community. We've had some great discussions tonight with some people from the community about possible ways ahead that we can go off and explore further. There's also discussions about what we could do for Because one of the things isn't it just about our level three children doing A-levels, it's about our level two children, those that need to retake their English and maths GCSEs and maybe offering some other level two qualifications. So you're very mindful of there's a range of children, young people out there who will access education in different ways, and we want to try and keep that going.
Mm. So how do you compete with places like Exeter, which are so big and offer so much? I mean, it must be difficult.
It is, and I think this is a challenge for rural post-16 provision. And I know we've lost a couple of other sixth forms in Devon in the last year or two. One of the things that is attractive for young people, I think, is quite often they've built good relationships with the teachers already in their school, and then those teachers go on to teach them A-levels. So that can be really important to them. For some young people, actually, all the travel, because it make their day very long, and it can be very expensive because parents obviously have to pay travel now in post 16. And some just prefer much smaller, more intimate sites. They don't want the big busyness of the city. And, you know, a lot of young people who do A-levels go on to university, and then they get that experience when they're a bit older. So you offer something a bit different, and that's kind of what you want to protect and what you want to try and keep offering for our young people.
Parent Hannah Ramsey said Okehampton College had been really good experience for her eldest sons, but less so for her third son after the college had leadership issues.
I have a child in year 10, and I have had three older children who have all gone through the school, two of whom stayed on for sixth form.
So how do you feel about these proposals?
I'm absolutely devastated. I think it's going to be a terrible thing for the community if the sixth form closes. I can't imagine how my older children who stayed here in the sixth form would have fared if they had been forced to go to Exeter College. The environment just wouldn't have suited them.
And why is that? Can you just tell me why?
Number one, getting up an hour earlier and having to travel would have affected them for sure. And number two, just a busier environment where they weren't known by the members of staff. You know, they'd been here since my eldest son started in 2013, and he'd been here right the way from year seven. He'd had a very positive experience here. The staff knew him by name. I felt the pastoral system was right for him and my next son down as well. They were well looked after. They were well known. They were nurtured, and it was, you know, and they achieved. If they'd had to go to Exeter, where they were in a much busier, noisier environment where the staff didn't necessarily know who they were, I don't think they would have thrived in the same way that they did here. I trained as a teacher myself, and I know that schools and colleges which provide sixth form education or A-level education will attract a higher calibre of teaching staff. So they will come because they want the opportunity to be able to teach up to A-level. And if they don't have that opportunity, if school doesn't have a sixth form, they will choose to go and teach somewhere else, which means that potentially the teaching quality will reduce for the lower years as well.
Former pupil Richard Smallwood praised the quality of the sixth form, and he said all young people of Okehampton should have this facility available to them.
I attended sixth form here in my time. The sixth form at Okehampton was transformative in my life and in the cohort of kids that I were with. So from my cohort, we've folks all over the country and, well, all over the world doing great stuff. My own children attended Okehampton sixth form post-16. My son's about to graduate from Aberystwyth. My daughter had a few issues at school. Exeter College was mooted as an opportunity, but dear old Okehampton sixth form came through. The pastoral care at the sixth form is just incredible, has been. The sixth form at Okehampton post-16 is essentially the jewel in the crown of the school. I would suggest that in my children's time and mine, most kids in the school would look up and aspire to being part of the post-16. And places like Exeter College, they're great. And I myself have taught in higher education. We've had, you know, kids come from that direction, and they've got a huge wide offer. But I believe Okehampton offers something very special in its pastoral care and brings the best from some of those children who aren't quite yet ready to go forward. And in my own children's experience, there have been a number of teachers here. If I may name Miss Carter, Mrs. Carter is one of the maths teachers who my son is so grateful for, the extracurricular maths work that she did with him, that has benefited him every step of the way through university.
A lot of people are saying that to me here tonight, but the fact of the matter is that only 12 have signed up for next year.
Well, I think far from being considering potentially closing post-16, I mean, surely the more sensible route to go is to look at the offer that's being put forward to rethink it and reinvest in it. The facilities are here, the teaching staff are here, they're supremely dedicated. Diverse range of interest to be offered. I think evidently there's a mismatch between possibly what the sick form is offering and possibly what the cohort want. And certainly the encouragement should be there for all kids to go forward and do their A-levels or MBQs if that's appropriate. If we can't see our way to funding and giving the very best for the cohort of today as we have done for the cohort of the past, I think it's a pretty sad job. And we are actually currently under a Labour left-wing government rather than a Conservative. So it would appear the Conservative government's been far more supportive of further education in Okehampton than perhaps the Labour lot. But yeah, there needs to be a cohesive drive forward to provide this. And if Tavistock can do it, we can jolly well do it in Okehampton.
I asked County Councillor James Granger what sort of reaction he was getting from people who attend the drop-in session.
It's been a mixed reception. I think some people are a little bit disappointed that it's even been proposed this way. A lot of people have thought that the college isn't really selling itself to get new students in. That's been quite a common thing. A few people have spoken to me tonight about that, saying, well, my child is in year 9, year 8, and actually the college is not really doing anything to sort of encourage them to want to go to that college. Meanwhile, the colleges next to are looking new and shiny and flash and offering the world, and they've been drawn to that. I think there's an element of short-termism in this, in the sense that if we do close, we do have an increase in population, and maybe in sort of 15 years' time, we're going to be kicking ourselves thinking, we could really do with a college. So there's an element of that. We clearly know why they're doing this, and it's because there are not enough students subscribing. But I think if you get rid of the college, you're taking away that opportunity for lots of people in the future as well, because once this is gone, it might be very difficult to sort of reintroduce it.
In 2023, Ofsted inspectors rated Okehampton College as requiring improvement in overall effectiveness. The report highlighted that the school had experienced significant leadership changes, which had contributed to a lack of confidence amongst pupils and parents. Parents at the session last week said they felt like the school was starting to turn a corner, but sixth form student Catherine Eilott said to get a larger intake, it needed to work to change the views amongst the younger pupils.
There hasn't been that much opportunity for students to really experience the sixth form lifestyle, and I know that from GCSE there's a lot of opinions on how the school runs, there's a lot of behavioural issues, etc., that run throughout the lower years. But I think as soon as you get up to sixth form, the behavioural issues within the classroom disappear because people want to be there and they want to learn. So all of those issues kind of dissipate. And I think the biggest thing is trying to shift the younger years' opinions and view of Okehampton College to something that's more positive.
I asked new principal Gareth Smith, who's been at the college since September, if he thought several changes in principals might have impacted the drop in students joining up for the sixth form. This is what he said.
I think all changes are done for the right reasons at that moment in time. I'm here. I've been quite clear with staff and with parents. I want to stay here for a bit. I think the school needs a leader to stick around for a bit so the students know they've got someone who loves and cares for them. And that's what I want to be for now.
Principal of Okehampton College, Gareth Smith there, as Okehampton College considers options for the sixth form. The consultation runs until July the 8th and is available on Devon County Council's website, and all views will be taken into consideration.
You're listening to Devoncast from Radio X and the Local Democracy Reporting Service. It's available from your regular podcast provider and on Devoncast Radio across the county.
I've been to the pictures this week.
Lucky
it's very,
you.
Very, exciting. Very. I've been twice, actually. I'll tell you, and I'm going again at the weekend. I'll tell you about that as well.
Goodness.
But one of the films that everybody in this county, I imagine, will be thinking about seeing if they haven't seen it already is The Salt Path, which is a film starring Gillian Anderson and Jason Isaac. It's based on the book by Rayna Wynn. True story about how she and her husband fell on desperately hard times and set out to walk the Southwest Coast Path as a way of basically confronting the times that they had, a way of sorting things out. They started walking, they just kept walking. It's a great film. It's a proper recommendation from me. Have you read the book, or is it...
No.
It's supposed to be very, very good. The film has got very good reviews. It's getting one from me as well. But the Coast Path is the absolute star of the film.
That's what I'm seeing. I'm seeing adverts everywhere about the coast path and the locations. So that's getting me interested.
it looks tough, mind. You know, there's some big hills, especially on that north bit. You know, we're down, I live down on the south part. But the thing about the coast path is I was on it yesterday working. I went did a job on Torquay Harbourside, as you'll hear in a minute. And I'm on the coast path. And, you know, you're down, Brad, you're down in the South Hams. You're not very far from it. Ali, you're a little bit further inland, aren't you? But it's not far to get onto the coast. And it's a magnificent thing, isn't it?
Yeah. And I cover North Devon anyway. So a lot of it was filmed up there. So any opportunity to get to the coast when I'm up there covering a meeting, I do, for sure.
I know that the tourist authorities have mentioned this film as possibly driving quite a bit of business this year, and I imagine it will. It looks great. Doesn't look easy, but it looks great. It's a good film. Go see it.
I think as well, from a local democracy aspect as well, I think councils are going to be more and more keen to encourage productions like The Salt Path to them, because if filming takes place on any council-owned property or land, then there are charges for that, which means councils can earn money. And actually, the amount that East Devon Council is going to charge such things like film productions got spoken about at the budget meeting a few months ago, so they're probably thinking about that. And I spoke to Screen Devon a few weeks ago now, and they made reference to a shoot apparently in East Devon, which something in the region of £700,000 was spent in 10 days by a production. So this is, you know, even if the council doesn't earn money directly from that, and in this case I don't think it necessarily did, but these big film productions, people are coming to an area, there's lots of crew, there's lots of staff, they spend money, they stay places. It's potentially bolstering the very local economy, so there is a bit of a push to make sure that Devon does attract big productions, big films, because they come with a lot of the people who are going to spend money.
They do, and lots of local authorities are putting money into Screen Devon, aren't they? They include East Devon, Exeter City Council, Mid Devon, North Devon, Torridge and Plymouth Culture. And when you think about it, Devon's got 2 national parks, 5 national landscapes, 2 World Heritage sites and a UNESCO Biosphere Reserve, so it's pretty epic, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. Who wouldn't want to come and film here? And it's always good to go to the cinema and see a local location on screen, isn't it? There was that film, The Unlikely Journey of, I've forgotten the name, Jim Broadbent was in it. It was brilliant.
Yes.
And
Totnes and Kingsbridge, that was filmed.
He walked up through the South Hams. It was filmed on location. It looked fabulous.
Yeah. So, can't remember the name.
It's The Unlikely Journey of
Harold Fry?
Yes, you've got it.
Yes.
Thank heavens for that. I thought we were going to have to publish a podcast with that great big hole in it. But that's a good film. I also, the other great thing was, and other cinemas are available, we have to say this in order to be unbiased, but I saw it at the Totnes Cinema, which is a magnificent little venue. Doesn't have rows of seats, it has tables and chairs and sofas, and there's a little bar that opens up beforehand.
Yeah.
It's well worth going to see.
I'll just do a big up for the Merlin Cinema in Okehampton and the Wolf in Tavistock while we're at it.
Well, I was in the Merlin Cinema in Torquay last night seeing The Ballad of Wallace Island, which is, I really recommend that one as well. And on Saturday, I'm going to see F1, the movie, and I'm expecting an assault on the senses from that one. But I'll tell you about that another time.
Oh, I can't wait.
Now, taking a turn away from popular culture to a controversial planning application for up to 100 homes at the site of a historic house in a mid-Devon town, which has been waved through after a planning appeal. Around 170 residents lodged formal objections to the scheme at Tiverton's Titcombe Hall, ahead of Mid-Devon District Council opting to refuse the scheme for the second time last year. But the developer, called Titcombe Holdings, lodged an appeal against the rejection with the Planning Inspectorate. Inspector Tom Gilbert Waldridge heard both sides of the argument over a period of 2 weeks across May and June this year, and has now decided to allow the appeal and approve planning permission. Now, it's worth stating the permission is for an outline application, which means the developer will now need to submit a full application that will include more specific details, including the likes of how the properties will be spaced out on the site, their design, and crucially the actual number, because the outline permission is for up to 100 homes. The decision led to an outcry by the ruling Liberal Democrat Party, with leader Luke Taylor calling it a devastating decision that he said was a direct consequence of the recent adjustment to housing targets by the government. Councils need to have a 5-year housing land supply, and while Mid-Devon has 4.79 years now, that's set to fall as new government housing targets take effect. One resident, Gough Welchman, who opposed the scheme and spoke at the planning inspectorate hearing, reacted to the decision.
It's a disaster, and myself, the team of people that work with me on fighting the application and the public inquiry, and the record number of objectors to the scheme, and it was an all-time record for a planning application in Mid-Devon, were all bitterly disappointed.
You spent a lot of time, didn't you, as well, sort of trying to help and gather support to the objection, as it were, at the planning meeting last year, but also at the planning inspectorate hearing.
I did, and I attended the public inquiry every day. I made an opening statement, as did several other people. We had all coordinated our statements to make sure we weren't duplicating and therefore boring the inspector. I then attended every other day, cross-examined the appellant's expert witnesses, and I thought I asked some very relevant questions. And then I made a closing statement. At the end of the day, I think we lost purely on the fact that the inspector was dominated by the land supply issue.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, where do you think it went wrong? Because that does seem to be the overarching theme, and certainly the comments that have come out of the cabinet at Mid-Devon District Council seem to be looking wholly really at this, the annual housing targets and the five-year housing land supply. And so do you kind of feel that that really is the reason that the inspectors pushed this one through?
That's the real cruncher. He did address in his statement and his judgment all the points that we made and did his best to counter them. But certainly the overarching problem was the land supply. What annoyed me about that was he did concede that the original refusal of the application was justified because at that time the council was meeting the land supply targets. But he said we have to work with existing circumstances now. And the land supply has fallen to less than 3 years as opposed to a five-year target. He based his judgment on that. Now, at the inquiry, I did actually bring that point up. And I said, if you judge the application on today's conditions as opposed to when the application was originally judged, you're moving the goalposts.
Do you feel then that Mid-Devon's been a bit hard done by? Because you are a relatively frequent critic of various areas of Mid-Devon District Council business. But in this instance, do you think they've been hard done by and they kind of fought the best they could?
I do think they've been hard done by, but I still lay the blame for what's happened wholly at their door.
Why is that then?
That site should never have been designated as a housing contingency site. It's completely inappropriate. Everybody's conceded that since, and our local ward councillors have said to me that they will be campaigning in the next local plan to have that site removed as a contingency. But of course, that is sadly, shutting the stable door after the horse has bolted.
That was Gough Welchman there giving his view about the decision. And Councillor Steve Keeble also expressed his feelings about the inspectorate's move to approve the decision.
Well, we're deeply disappointed, and it's got nothing to do with our local plan, and it's got everything to do with government shifting the goalposts when their eagerness to build new houses. Really, the inspector has used the national policy just to trump the local policy and local democracy.
So you don't feel then that Mid-Devon's reasons for refusing it initially were maybe not perhaps as strong as they should have been, and it just would have been maybe outweighed, have they, by this whole point about how many houses Mid-Devon needs to build?
Yeah, they've been totally outweighed. I mean, last August it was refused because it was not part of the local plan. It was beyond the settlement boundary, and the impact upon the countryside, the Grand Western Canal and the historic setting of Tidcombe Hall. But the inspector has set that aside completely after government shifted the goalposts 6 months ago in its race to build 1.5 million new homes.
But I guess what the inspector might say and what the developer might say is, when you did refuse this, you knew full well that this change was coming and that you weren't going to be able to show such a strong housing supply into the future. And so really, you should have applied that properly to your decision last year.
No, we didn't know that that decision was going to be coming. The decision was made before the government announced that it was going to consult on increasing the housing targets.
Okay, you may have made the decision, then the government changed its mind on how many houses per year councils have to build, and then we've had the appeal and...
That's right. The government moved the goalposts, and this is the second appeal that we've lost within a week. And Mid Devon doesn't go for losing appeals, and it's all to do with these housing targets that have been, which are a right to have them, but we're ready to build houses in the right place to the east of Columpton. That's all part of the local plan, but that's not taken into account.
Are you worried then that there could be more applications down the line that you refuse for similar reasons to the Tidcombe Hall one, but then get approved at an appeal because of this weight that I'm guessing planning inspectors will have to now give to the housing targets that councils now face?
That has a very simple answer. Yes. We're all shaking our boots because we don't know what's coming. And it's just ridiculous that, you know, government have increased virtually overnight by 65% the number of houses that we were to build. We were building well above the target, our previous target. They're not allowing any time for plans to be put into place, and we're still working on the old plan of the previous council. It takes 5 years to shift gear into a new plan. There hasn't been the time, but more than anything, government have been delaying the announcements on the Columpton M5 Junction 28 improvement. That, if we had that decision through, would unlock the Calm Garden village and the 5,000 houses there.
So just for people listening who might not know about the housing targets, so the council's housing target has basically risen from 346 per year to 571 homes per year, like you said, representing a 65% increase. So that is a huge number to try and, you know, achieve, isn't it? But I guess one thing that you said there that interested me was that you feel a bit, I guess, aggrieved by the fact that the council has a plan, but the inspector said, oh yeah, but it takes a long time for plans to come to fruition, so actually we're just gonna have to let this one go through anyway, this particular scheme.
Absolutely, that's the case. The goalposts have shifted, but the government is aiming at the wrong goal. It's looking at new planning permissions. And yeah, March last year, we had over 2,000 new homes with planning permissions. But at this point, 75% of those houses that have already got planning permissions haven't been implemented at all.
One thing that the planning inspectorate noted with Tidcombe Hall is that this scheme will bring forward on the site 30% of it will be affordable homes. That's above the statutory requirement. So isn't that a good thing really for Tiverton?
Or it might be wishful thinking. We don't know. I mean, this is the sustainability, the viability of the calculations that the developer will really need to look at. The inspector has imposed 29 conditions. Now it's down to the developer to actually go away and look at the market, the conditions, and come forward with the detail. Now, this is not yet a done deal at all. It is just the outline planning permission that has been given permission. But this has been very, very expensive for Mid Devon as a council, as taxpayers, to actually defend at an appeal, which is why we're so devastated by losing it based upon sound planning principles.
I understand as well, Councillor Keeble, that I've read, I think, in the report that the other side is going to seek costs from Mid Devon. Is that correct?
Yes, they will do. And we anticipate that will be a six-figure number.
That's a big number for a council.
It really is a big number. And these planning appeals, the 2 weeks of the appeal and the build-up to that, with all the officer time and the barrister time, that's about 80,000 will in defending this planning position. So yeah, that's a lot of money for people locally to be stumping up when it's down to government shifting the goalposts.
That was Councillor Steve Keeble speaking to me there. Now, Tidcombe Holdings LLP will need to submit a full planning application, but it's not clear yet when that will be.
Now, hundreds of the world's best paddleboarders will be setting course for Torbay next June as the bay hosts the 2026 SUP World Cup, SUP standing for Stand Up Paddleboarder. The event was launched this week at the Hampton by Hilton Hotel on Torquay Harbourside with some of the biggest names in British paddleboarding in the room. Among them was Brendan Prince. Brendan is a former teacher in Torquay who was inspired to campaign for water safety after a tragic accident on a Cornish beach in 2014. As an off-duty lifeguard, he was involved in trying to save the lives of three surfers who got into trouble in big waves. He did everything he could, both in and out of the water, but all three lost their lives in front of their families that day. Since that day, Brendan has put his all into the cause of water safety. He's so far the only person to paddle a stand-up paddleboard all the way around Britain in one go, and now he's the local face of the SUP World Cup. I started by asking him where the athletes would be coming from.
Literally all over. So I've had, in the last week alone, athletes from Puerto Rico, Miami, France, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, saying, look, where's our nearest airports? What are the logistics for them? Because we have to set up the logistic plan for getting there. You know, these boards are big, 14 foot. How we get them here, what we can provide. So now we're already talking logistically about getting those athletes from all around the world with all their kit.
And what does a SUP race look like? For people who haven't seen one, people are going to be, you know, on the waterfront there by Tor Abbey and Palm Court. What's it going to look like?
Well, that's the beauty of the key. So there are three key events: sprints, technical, and distance. Sprints, 100, 125 metres. We'll have the platform that they start off and they race into the beach. So it's 100 miles an hour. It's frantic. There's water. It's going everywhere because you'd be amazed how fast you can go. Yeah. And then it's a 2 or 3 metre sprint up the beach to the finish line. So that's really impactful. The technical event in Tor Abbey Sands is around 10 different buoys. So it's a race, but you've got to turn on every buoy with everybody watching you from the promenade and the stadium seating. So on every turn, people can get knocked off, knocked over, passed. It's the essence of kind of watching racing because you never know. You know, with one turn to go, who will win? Because that last turn, it can be an important. And then the final one is the distance event, which really showcases the English Riviera. Start in Torquay, goes over to Paignton and back, 10K. You know, it's a real spectacle to take in the beauty of the bay, really.
Now, what is it? Three years ago now, you went all the way around this brilliant island of ours, and you've seen every beach. What is it that makes Torbay so special?
So when I think about beaches, I think about what is the water quality like? Because when you're out there, you want it to be good. And unfortunately, in our waters at the minute around the UK, there are parts that I don't go to anymore because the water quality is that bad. Beautiful locations, but bad water quality because of what is happening, what pollution is being put in there. Then about the flow and where is the natural conditions coming from. We traditionally have south-southwesterlies, which means we get loads of sheltered water for predominantly 80-90% of the time. And then, of course, you know, I love when I've had a hard paddle, a hard training session, I love to go and have a coffee, or I want all that to be easy. I don't want to have to traipse aboard a mile to get to a beach. So you bring all that together and all of a sudden you've got a perfect location that no matter what the weather is doing, so it's 20 miles an hour today, there are some beaches that most people wouldn't want to go on today, but you can find another beach that you can, that will be sheltered.
And what sort of support have you had from the ER Bid Company and from Torbay Council?
Phenomenal. And I truly mean that because, you know, I've run events, water events in the bay now for over 25 years. And there was a time when you would suggest an event and it fell on deaf ears. It really did. It was really hard. The council, the councillors, the ER Bid Company, all the plan for the destination development for the English Riviera is so on point at the minute and supportive. So all those different organisations have been absolutely, what can we do to help? So being really proactive. So it's enabled an event of this size to really, you know, make, because let's face it, when we were awarded it, we only have 15 months to put it on, which is half the time you should have, really. But because of those proactive organisations, we were able to do this and make it deliver for 1 year to go.
And your personal journey to this and water safety came from a very tragic incident that we've reported on before. Could you ever see it coming to something like this? And will this help you get that message across?
Do you know what? The essence of what you just said is if I said, let's chat about water safety for an interview, you'd be like, oh, you know, because that's the general, who wants to hear about water safety? So the more I can do to put on and do things. So I paddled around the UK because then people wanted to talk to me about water safety, or they just saw it in what I was doing. We put on an international event like this and people can just see what is good practice. The health and happiness that we're promoting obviously means that you've got to do it safely. So we will be wearing buoyancy aids. We will be doing it properly in every way. And just modeling that behavior is a great way of getting that message across. So of course, until we have zero people dying of accidental drowning in the UK, I'm not going to be happy.
Paddleboard pioneer Brendan Prince there, talking about how the SUP World Cup will help spread the message of water safety. He also credited Torbay Council for getting behind the event in a big way. Here's Conservative Councillor Jackie Thomas, the Council's Cabinet Minister. I've promoted you, Jackie, sorry. The Cabinet Member for Tourism and Events.
This is absolutely fantastic, and I'm delighted here today to be celebrating 1 year until the stand-up paddleboarding World Cup begins. It's going to be massive for our bay. You know, it's going to help our economy, hopefully the visitor numbers, to support our hotels, our restaurants, our cafes, our businesses. So it's all really good news for Torbay.
And Brendan was just saying how enormously supportive the council has been, and events are really key to the success of the bay, aren't they?
Yeah, yes they are, and being as that is my portfolio, you know, I am fully supportive. When Brendan came to us with his ideas, you know, I sat up immediately and thought this could be a fantastic opportunity for us here in the bay. And you know, what could be better than on the backdrop of our English Riviera? It molds itself so well, and you know, it also is going to help our youngsters as well get into the sport, raise awareness of water safety and the benefits that that all creates. So yeah, it's going to have that lasting legacy as well, which I think is absolutely perfect here for the bay.
And from a council point of view, it's about everything from the big things, they making sure that everything's fine out on the water, down to getting the toilets fixed, isn't it? So you've got a lot of work to do.
We have indeed. We, in fact, 2 minutes ago, I was having that very conversation about toilets, etc., parking, and it's that infrastructure that helps an event go well. And, you know, and that is all those little nuts and bolts that we are putting in behind the scenes as we speak.
Looking forward to it?
I'm immensely looking forward to it. On the back of the success of our English Riviera air show and our Bay of Lights, this is up there with them as well. So, you know, it's very exciting and we're all buzzing to get going, and we look forward to next year for 2026.
Councillor Jackie Thomas there. Earlier, Brendan Prince was also full of praise for the English Riviera Bid Company, the body which promotes Torbay's tourism, hospitality and events. Here's CEO Carolyn Custerson on what the event could mean for the Bay.
The legacy could be enormous, because as big a thing is the World Cup, the next year, the end of June, we could go on to host the World Championships. And as a destination, if we actually secure our ambition and vision, which is to be the SUP capital of the UK, like Newquay is the capital for surfing, and we absolutely nail it next June and deliver a world-class event, which we're very capable of doing, some excellent people on board with Brendan Prince leading it, the opportunities going forward are even as if not more exciting, because we become, you know, we secure our place as the SUP World Cup destination, and people from all around the world will start to travel here to get out on our water.
And as Brendan was saying, there can't be very many places that no matter which way the wind's blowing, you've got a sheltered beach in Torbay.
Yeah, that's what's unique about the bay. And it's, you know, there's 20 odd beaches. We're a UNESCO Global Geopark. There's no other British resort that is a UNESCO Global Geopark. And for SUP person, they absolutely love to take the opportunity to go through the 400 million year old London Bridge.
Is it possible to put a figure on how much this might bring into Torbay in terms of bed nights and hospitality spend, or is it too early to say?
I think it's a little early to say. I haven't done that calculation yet. There's 200 international SUP boarders, but where the value is with the supporting spectators, family and friends. So we're saying around 2,000 people staying 7 nights, because it's a week-long festival. It's not just a one-day event or a short weekend. It's a week-long festival that includes the World Cup race. So the actual worth, it's millions. We've just got to do that calculation. But what the actual value is putting the English Riviera and in all its glory on the world stage, with photographs and Instagram and TikTok, and showcasing this destination throughout the world. And, you know, if the weather's kind to us, like it was for the air show, you know, what price do you put on that?
Absolutely. And with the air show and with Agatha Christie, the walking festival, with this event, is it fair to say that Torbay's turned a bit of a corner?
We have, and it's through investment. So the bid company alone has invested £500,000 in the last 4 years in the development of what we're calling signature events. They're events that will attract overnight stays, that will become very attractive on Facebook and Instagram, and pictorially, you know, spread the word. And so we see events as a key part of our destination marketing strategy.
Caroline Custerson, the CEO of the English Riviera Bid Company and a Devoncast regular, explaining what the SUP World Cup could mean for Torbay. Get it in your diary. Opening ceremony on the 24th of June 2026 in Torquay.
Have you ever tried paddleboarding, anyone?
Well, yeah, I've got some paddleboarding. Actually, I haven't been to the cinema this week, but I have actually gone paddleboarding this week up the River Dart, and it was just, it's wonderful.
Oh, brilliant.
Did you stay on?
I stayed on, yeah.
Oh, well done.
I've never paddleboarded. Perhaps I need to put that right.
It's harder than you think, though.
It is harder than you think. You do get used to it. But, we have paddleboards at home. And also, in the village we live in, we can actually jump on the water in a car park in the village and just paddle all the way down to Bantham on the tide. So that's really nice.
Sounds idyllic. Now, you can enter this World Cup. One of the things Brendan said to me yesterday was, the world's best will be there, and they're pretty quick. But in the heats, anyone can enter. You could bring your paddleboards up, and you could put them in the water at Torquay, and you could take on the world's best.
We'll come and cheer you on.
Maybe I'll get practicing.
Brad, you should do that. We'd make a great piece for Devoncast.
That's all we ever think about in life as well. Will this make a good piece for Devoncast?
That is very true. Very true. Now, the Torbay Place Leadership Board, it's a bit of a mouthful, but you need to get used to it, because you're going to be hearing a lot more about it over the next few years. It's the organisation with the job of spending £20 million of government money given to Torquay for unspecified revenue and capital projects. They're unspecified in that none has yet been identified, and that's where the community comes in. The board will soon be asking local people to submit their ideas for projects to make the most of the decade-long programme, and money could go to anything from a major building project to a single dog bin on the roadside. The membership of the board is very varied. Torbay's MP is on it, as well as the leader and chief executive of Torbay Council, and representatives from local businesses, community, youth and religious groups. The Devon and Cornwall Police Commissioner is a member, as is the co-chairman of Torquay United. The chairman of the board, I can start singing for you in a minute if you like, is the editor of the Torbay Weekly, Jim Parker. I asked him what it was all about.
So today is literally trying to create a new life for the residents of Torquay. So the funding is aimed at Torquay. It's called the Pounds Neighbourhood. It was long-term funding before the election. It's now been changed, with a huge focus now on the community driving that funding.
And what, be more specific a little bit about why it's Torquay and not Torbay, because people elsewhere in Torbay, there is a council grant scheme which has just been launched, but this is specifically Torquay, isn't it?
Yeah, so this was based on lots of facts and figures that went to government, and the bid was made on behalf of Torquay when it came to deprivation, child obesity, health levels, age dependency, and all that sort of stuff. And so the bid was for Torquay and Torquay only at the time being, and it's to benefit the community. But lots of facts and figures just backing up the fact that Torquay was in need of this community help.
And how do you see, I know it's early days and the projects haven't come in yet, but how do you see some of the ways that this money might be spent? Because a lot of it is for capital and not revenue, isn't it?
Yeah, so listen, you can be talking about one big project, you can be talking about 50 little projects. There's any project that makes life better for somebody living and working in Torquay. So I went to a meeting in Westminster last week where Angela Rayner just emphasised that this was part of the people, and they would decide from the bottom up, not the top down, what would make that life better for those people. So yeah, it could be big projects, could be little projects, but it's anything really. I mean, one member of the meeting said in Westminster, it could be even a dog pooping in a park, which would improve the lives of residents, even to that level. I think the challenge that we've got is there will be so many schemes being submitted. We've got to be realistic to make sure we pick the ones that make the most benefit to the ordinary resident.
And from the dog poo bin in the park, it can go up to something as big as regenerating a shopping area or something like that.
I think as long as you can identify how that's going to benefit the residents, then that's a possibility. It's not there to build big shopping complexes, but it might be there to finish off something that needs something else to get it over the line, which would benefit Torquay. Emphasise, it's got to benefit the people of Torquay.
And so if somebody's sitting there thinking, I really want to get involved with this, I want to put forward my scheme, somebody who's got an idea like making Melville Marvellous, which was a great success, what do they do next?
So we've got a brilliant group of people around the table now from the community across different sections. So what's going to happen now is that we will have another informal meeting where we'll talk about what schemes they'd like to come up with, what priorities might be. But more important, we're going to go out to the general public, to the community, and ask them what they want to see in Torquay to improve their lives, come back, agree some priorities, and then maybe do an open call for submissions to the community at large. So we've got, and again, we've got to be realistic. If you have 1,000 schemes, you might deliver 20, but those 20 make a huge difference.
And looking at the people around the table today, just finally, you've got some real movers and shakers in Torbay here. This could be a real watershed for the town, couldn't it?
Yeah, it could. And I think that the biggest thing for me is that we spend too long a time talking about things and not delivering. And I think the people in the room have already delivered for their communities as they are. And this is just a way of developing that delivery and making sure life is better for everybody.
Jim Parker, editor of the Torbay Weekly and chair of the Torquay Place Leadership Board, explaining what could be a really powerful project for the town.
And that's it for this edition of Devoncast. From next week, we've got a change. We'll still be covering our local councils and the decisions they make that affect people in Devon, but we'll have more stories too on arts, culture, theatre and things going on. And myself, Guy and Brad will be reporting on the issues, but the Radio X team is taking over the presentation. That's because we're moving over to join Devon Live as the BBC's local democracy reporting service makes a switch. It's been a pleasure to present Devoncast for the past 2 years, and we hope you'll continue to listen. Next week, Paul Nero will be here with, among other top stories, a murder mystery in Devon, courtesy of Jeremy Vine. We're dying to hear it.
Catch the latest episode of Devoncast every Friday at radiox.co.uk or wherever you get your podcasts.